Hello, it's Fourth Estate for the week beginning Monday the 22nd of June 2015. Live on 2SER Radio and across the Community Radio Network, your weekly look at the world of journalism and the media. My name's Jack Fisher. This week, we're putting the spotlight on photojournalism, and I'm very lucky to be joined by some of Sydney's finest photojournalists here in the studio. Tamara Vininsky, a freelance photographer and founder of the Australian photojournalism collective Oculi. Did I get that right? Welcome to Fourth Estate. We've also got Craig Greenhill, photojournalist with the Daily Telegraph. Hi, Craig. And we've got Sam Moy, photojournalist with the Australian Associated Press. How are you going?
Hey, Jack. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Now, you two are among the Photostrada collective, I should mention. That's another Australian photojournalism collective. And also among Photostrada is Melbourne photojournalist Tracy Nearmy, who you might have heard of recently. She's the photographer who took a photo of the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Peter Credlin, at a media event a couple of weeks ago, and she was asked by Credlin to delete the picture. I spoke to Tracy about it a little bit earlier.
I can't see a reason why a politician would ask for a photo to be deleted unless a photographer was breaking the law and getting the photo, say, by photographing through their bedroom window or their bathroom window without asking permission. They might wish that you hadn't taken it and wish that it was deleted, but that's out of the question. This is the first time it's ever happened to me, but Peter Credlin is a politician, so it's never happened that a politician's asked for a photo to be deleted. So.
What was your take on the non-photographer's area that she was trying to get at when you spoke to her?
It was just a hallway. I hadn't been told that there weren't areas I was allowed to photograph in, so I didn't know that supposedly this area was a non-photography area. We were just told that we weren't allowed to come through the front part of the police station for security reasons, and that was all. And afterwards, the police told me that it was fine that I photographed in the area as long as you couldn't see anything on the walls behind her. So.
Is it conceivable that she just thought it was an unflattering photo, or do you think there's some sort of political element to it?
I think it was a political element to it. I think she just didn't want to be photographed or be seen or be in the spotlight at all. So I think that was her take on it.
Is photojournalism, is it generally a game of ask forgiveness rather than permission?
Because we don't set up photos to recreate the event, if we miss it the first time, you have to often shoot first and ask questions later or you'll miss the picture. In some cases, like photographing children, I'll ask permission from the parents after I've taken the photo and we'll go by their guides on that. But yes, often you have to take the photo first or you miss the moment.
And so when Peter was saying, could you delete that please? And you were saying, well, I have to speak to my chief of staff first. You have to stand up to that, don't you?
Yes, yes. Well, unfortunately, we get these kind of requests regularly in our day-to-day duties, and we have a policy we just don't delete photos. So I'm kind of used to telling people that, no, I can't delete the photo. So for that situation, I did really need to just speak to my picture editor first. And
to what extent are you regularly considering, I suppose, the political implications of a photo that you take when you're chasing it and when you're composing it?
We're always looking for pictures which will illustrate what is happening in politics at the time. I don't really consider the political implications as such, but I try and provide a fair and accurate portrayal of the event and take photos that will work well with current and future stories in politics.
That's AAP photojournalist Tracy Nearmy speaking there about the picture that she took of Peter Credlin a couple of weeks back. You're on Fourth Estate. My name's Jack Fisher, and I'm joined by photojournalists Tamara Vininsky, Craig Greenhill and Sam Moy. Sam, how often does a subject ask for their photo to be deleted?
I think it's really hit and miss with that, Jack. I mean, we find it, depending on the circumstance, I've had it a fair few times in my career. I can say safely that across multiple organisations I've worked for, we don't delete pictures. We know that, and we work within a bound of the boundary of media ethics and the rule of law, and we sort of operate in terms of image collation based on that.
Would you agree, Tamara?
Absolutely. I've been a photographer for over 30 years, and I've never been asked to delete a photograph in my entire career. And I think politicians, like celebrities, know when they're on. And in a situation like this, everyone would have known there were photographers around. And
Craig, what do you do in that sort of a situation? It's a bit of an unusual request, it sounds like.
Oh, it's not unusual for me to be challenged by a subject or someone that doesn't want to be photographed, or even someone that has been photographed with permission and they go, oh, I don't like that photo, can you delete it? You're guided by the law. If you know what the law is, you know your rights, and then you don't delete photos unless your employer, because my employer owns the photograph, so you put it to them. It always takes the pressure off, but it doesn't mean that it stops people from getting aggressive in your face. I've had a boss of mine been harassed by the police and physically manhandled to get photographs off him, and the police were totally in the wrong.
And how often is there a sort of grey area there? Because I'm thinking of perhaps sort of shooting from, often you hear this, shooting from a public property onto private property and that sort of thing.
The law is not grey. If you have an understanding of the law and how it works, and to be refreshed on how it works, I hate to be quoted on the law, but I always go back and find out for myself what is the law change, and there's a black and white. People think that there are laws to protect them to be from being photographed, even if they're in a private residence, and often the case they don't have that protection. Often parents think their kids have special protections because they're at the beach or in a swimming pool, but there is, photography wise, there isn't specific laws saying you can't photograph the children. There are laws against pedophile and so on, so that it's there are grey areas in that way, but it all comes down to intention and where we've got an intention to record things for.
To document history.
Tracy obviously stood her ground to Peter Credlin. We saw a few months back, there was an NITV news video journalist who was challenged by the police to hand over his footage. What do you do in that sort of a situation, Sam? Do you have to just sort of stand your ground?
You stand your ground. And again, it comes down to having that education and knowing where you stand in the rule of law the public view. So if you're within public view and you can see an event unfolding, you are well within your rights to actually stand and document it.
Yeah. What do you think, Tamara?
Well, I believe I've always gone by a not only a sixth sense of what's right and what's wrong in these situations, but I've undertaken a lot of ethics and law training. So I know my rights as a photographer and in various countries where I travel. And as I said before, I've never had these images demanded to be deleted or anything of that nature. But yeah, you know, as photographers, we're often putting our lives on the line to witness these stories unfolding and to bring them back to be published. And everyone in this room is very well educated as to what our rights are, but also the respectful way to go around about taking photographs.
Craig, when a subject does challenge you, is that for reasons of vanity, or is it because they're seen doing something that they don't want to be seen doing?
Well, often the intention of my photographs are to capture people doing things they shouldn't be doing when they've been photographed without their permission. And they obviously don't want that record to be shown. And, you know, it's sort of, as a press photographer, it's sort of, I'm a bit of a chaser, and if I see someone doing something wrong, I'm a bit like the traffic cop. My job's to get a photograph of them doing that, and I guess I'm a tool for my newspaper to do that. You know, it's a way of them proving that people are breaking the law.
Yeah, Sam. A couple of years ago, I think you were set upon in public by, was it a union official?
Yeah, it was, look, again, kind of, you know, it's not the first time this has sort of happened to me in my career, but certainly probably the most well-publicised event. It was documented by a colleague of mine. It was a union official that was at the heart of an AWN Royal Commission, from memory, who just happened to be the ex-boyfriend of Julia Gillard. And again, chasing down, and I knew where I stood in terms of public view, and it was actually on the opening day of this inquiry, And it beggars belief that this particular person was actually sitting across the road having a cup of coffee despite not needed to appear or be anywhere within the vicinity. It was just kind of potluck. And a colleague of mine and I decided to get a today picture of him, or what we call a today picture, which basically involves us going and photographing him. We knew where we stood in terms of media and common law, and sometimes you've just got to get in front of it. And we initially gave this particular individual a bit of space and to do it respectfully, and unfortunately he didn't want to be a part of it, which is understandable. He didn't want to be photographed. So we chased him, and we got in front of him, and he didn't like that, and then he got very aggressive very quickly. And sometimes this is part and parcel of news gathering, that people don't like being photographed. However, he, in terms of an image capture point of view, we were 100% in the right, and it was on a public street. And my colleague got a series of pictures of me, which managed to find its way onto every front page around the country, which is never what you want. You never want to be part of the story, but sometimes you it just transpires that way.
So is there ever a sense that, I suppose, the lens becomes a bit of a barrier between you and the world?
Absolutely right. And this is what I've found in terms of hostile environments or conflict photography, is that sometimes you can use it to your advantage, and that it can be, and other photojournalists have called it, a shield. But it can also be seen as the other side of the coin, which is you're a target because you've got a camera in front of your face. In fact, as soon as you put the cameras down, 9 times out of 10, they tend to back down and walk away. And it's not there to incite violence. In fact, quite the opposite. You just want to get in and do your job and get a clean picture of a person and file it and get on your way. But sometimes that they can...
Yeah. Do you think the sense of what a camera means in public has changed at all, Tamara? Do you feel like photojournalists are perhaps under threat more than ever?
Oh, under threat. That's a good question. Look, when I first started in photography, you know, big film cameras transpires to smaller film cameras. Now I carry a lot of digital cameras. I've never felt like a target. I've had 2 concussions in my life as a photographer, but it's not through being a target. It was various media scrums, and you two were probably there.
It's probably my elbows.
It probably was. I think it was a television news camera hitting me in the head or something along those lines. But anyways, I've never felt like I'm a target, but I think, as I said before, I have developed the sixth sense about where to be and what to do. And I think we all have this thing that keeps us alive in any sort of daily situation, daily news situation, daily situation, photographing on the streets or being overseas or wherever you might be, that you can feel the energy. You know what you should do and what you shouldn't do, and you follow those cues, because those are the cues that keep you alive as a photographer. And really, I think the people who experience this the most would be photojournalists, either still or film photographers, videographers, where you're right there witnessing life unfolding in front of you. And so you're the first person who's between, you know, a conflict and or in front of a conflict, and situations can get out of control. Now, luckily for me, they never have, but I think for these guys, they might have a different scenario.
Craig, I was asking Tracy there about to what extent she considers the political implications of a photo when she's framing it, when she's composing it, that sort of thing. Is that something that's running through your mind when you're in the field?
Not such implications, but politicians are easy targets. Sometimes you might want to look for a nice photo, but they're not people that they're not models, so they're easy to make look awkward or in scenarios where they don't like it. So the controls on the media are getting tighter and tighter. They like to have fixed press conference. They don't want anything going out of control, out of their field. I mean, you can see the Prime Minister has his own personal photographer now, who's taken the power of what we do and put it in a positive way. You know, you can show the positive side of people. I've had people, you know, like Nathan Rees, the Premier of New South Wales back a few years ago, he had a bit of a tell on a press conference. He was quite a boring person at a press conference talking, but if you fired a shutter at him often enough, and you know, just rattle it off, It rattles him. Hmm. And he used to get a tear coming to his eye. So you get that emotional side coming out of him. And I guess you're having a bit of an influence on what he looks like. But it was a little bit of fun. But, you could see that he was melting under pressure. And I guess that's what I was trying to show.
Hmm. You're on Fourth Estate. My name's Jack Fisher. And I'm joined by photojournalists Tamara Vininsky, Craig Greenhill and Sam Moy. Now, Tamara, you were a longtime photojournalist and picture editor with Fairfax Media, and Fairfax photo departments, well, they've suffered pretty heavy cuts in recent years. And it seems a testament, actually, to their photo newsrooms that they've survived some of those cuts to a degree. It seems that management there have really sought to shift to a deal that they have with Getty Images. What does a shift like that, how does that impact upon quality?
Well, I was made redundant from Fairfax in 2012, and the Getty deal came in, I believe, about 2 years later, after I left Fairfax. And I think in a lot of ways I'm still on the sidelines assessing what that deal has meant for the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, and the Australian Financial Review, who all have very specialised needs for their photography for various sections of the newspapers, the different magazines. And Getty is not considered a specialist photo agency, and it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. That was my thought a few years ago. Now, I'm not in the newsroom, and I'm not picture editing there, so I don't know how that has impacted, but I know it in terms of Oculi and the Photographic Collective, we always try to maintain our independence from big organizations like Getty or Corbis. And we never want to make alliances with other organizations that would turn into a Getty, where our images would just become part of Getty or become part of Corbis or whatever agency. So I think I think you'd have to ask someone who's actually within the organisation now, and maybe these guys might have some insight as well.
What do you think, Craig?
So I work for the Daily Telegraph, and up until Getty came on to the scene, I would regularly see Sydney Morning Herald photographers turn up to news events that we turn up to, and we just don't see any representative on most events that we go to now. So they aren't a news gathering organisation. They're not typically in Australia. They're very good at sport. They're very good at covering events. You know, they like big contracts like Fashion Week, and they take over Fashion Week, and well, to some degree, push out all the other smaller photographers. But you don't see them on the road. They're losing. If you lose the Fairfax news photographers, you're losing all the news instincts and hundreds of years of knowledge of how to work on a news event. You know, these guys, most of the guys at Fairfax have been there more than a decade, if not two. And it would be a big shame to lose the existing ones.
Yeah, so what I'm getting the sense of is it's one thing to be shooting fashion events and events, basically, and it's another to get that sort of reportage-style photography into the papers. What's the struggle like to really push that style of photography, Tamara?
Well, in terms of Fairfax and the Sydney Morning Herald, there's a beautiful style to the photographs, and with all the redundancies, there's thousands of years of experience in picture editing and photography that's walked out the door, which historically is just absolutely horrible. But in terms of Oculi, the photographic collective I'm part of, one thing we've always maintained is independence, and to be free from the mainstream media and traditional models such of that nature, and to basically to document the world around us and for history, and to show the extraordinary and the ordinary and the beauty, the wonder, and the struggle of everyday life through photography. And I think if you try to pigeonhole photography that it's part of this particular agency, part of Some of the best photographers in the world are based here in Australia. Mm. And the problem is that the work is not being shown. There were problems back in 2000 when we first started Oculi, and trying to publish long-term projects and photo essays, trying to find outlets within Australia. And that's why we created the group. But here we are 15 years later, and the market is nearly gone. The editorial market is gone for photography. And it's horrific. It's
yeah. Sam, some of the positives, perhaps. I mean, technology has obviously changed the game a lot. Does that mean deadlines have shifted forward, and is that more difficult, or has it become easier?
Well, if we're talking about news gathering as a daily publisher, then at AAP we publish as quickly as we have it. That's the point of a wire agency, is to get our images out first, and for publications to lean on us to get images for the digital platforms. In terms of reportage, this is kind of where we're finding that the print space isn't there anymore, or the magazines such as the Bulletin unfortunately have closed down, which used to show fantastic reportage from some of Australia's finest, including Oculi members and some members from Photostrata as well. We're at a point where we need to look at how we utilise the digital platform and what we turn the multimedia product into, and how we utilise those pictures to the best of our ability. We're sort of on the precipice of really turning it into great products again. But where's the market? That's the other thing.
You're on Fourth Estate. My name's Jack Fisher. Thinking about my favourite quote, Sam was asking in the break, what's my favourite quote about photojournalism? Well, it's this. It's by Susan Sontag. She once wrote about conflict and tragedy photography. The shock of photographed atrocities wears off with repeated viewing. In the past decades, concerned photography has done at least as much to deaden conscience as to arouse it. I want to ask, would you guys agree, Craig?
Well, possibly. We've seen a lot of gruesome, in-your-face death in the last decade. And I think it's a challenge for photojournalists to find other ways of capturing it without not just getting over the top of gruesome bodies and showing, you know, a World Press winner this year, Jerome Cecini, he had a beautiful set of images from the MH17 crash disaster, which showed death but in a different way, and showed the environment and, you know, interlinked with more human emotions in the package than just, just seeing a body, which I guess people just don't want to see consistently.
One of the big discussions we had on the show last year was around the Telegraph, I think it was, publishing the ISIS beheading photo. 2014 was obviously a really dark year. Are people becoming desensitized by that sort of photography, do you think, Sam?
That's a good question, Jack. I think it really comes down to the story. I think aside from the hard news value and the immediacy of the event, I think you need to look at also ways of telling that story without just graphic images. I think we need to look at a wider scope, but you won't probably find that these days in print as you would have 10 years ago, but how we can try and put that on a multimedia platform. Are people being desensitized? I think yes. But we have to find different ways of telling and getting our story across.
So how do you then make that decision of, well, do we show this, do we not? What sort of benchmark does it have to fulfill for a photo editor to choose to put something that's perhaps a little bit risque or perhaps a little bit gruesome?
Well, just to go back a little bit, I think we live in an era that's completely image saturated. Mm. And it takes a really extraordinary image to make a viewer stop and look again. And as a picture editor, I think, and as a photographer as well, by focusing on the emotional heart of a story visually, photojournalists can capture very powerful images that can draw a reader into a story. And by composing the photographs in a way to not show, as Craig had mentioned, the gruesomeness of a tragedy or a conflict. It's an art form. It takes courage and vision and intuition, logic, and even the ability to think quickly on your feet and constantly looking for better images that communicate the story. And I think that's the important thing. It's communicating the story and finding the power of the image and getting those images out there. And these photographers are witness every day to these daily stories. The fact that we're an image-saturated society and many people just flick through images very quickly, I think that makes the photographers have to work harder to come up with these extraordinary images, particularly of events that are perhaps gruesome and contain conflict and tragedy, and people go, oh, whatever. Let's bring people back to the image and to the heart of the story.
Yeah. Now, the Nikon Walkley Awards will be later this year, showcasing some of the best Australian photojournalism. Craig, you took a photo from, well, you took a few photos from the Cronulla riots, 10 years ago. They were certainly very confronting. Was that a bit of a watershed moment for Australian photojournalism? It seems like they really cut through in a way which some of the reporting may not have.
Well, it's a unique event that we hadn't seen for a long time, where the crowd turned into a riot sort of scenario, where we had access to the subjects weren't thinking about their actions and thinking about the media's influence or impact after the event. So, it was a watershed moment for my career. Learning not to hesitate, just get in there. As Tracy said earlier, you know, shoot first, ask questions later. You know, the reporters were nowhere up to the speed that the photographers were up to that day, capturing what was actually happening. If only we had technology that we have today, where we could have published instantaneously. Yep. But that was 10 years ago, where we were, hey, these are good pictures for tomorrow's paper.
Yeah, I don't think they would have been seeking forgiveness for any of the subjects on that one. That's it from us on Fourth Estate this week. Don't forget you can check out all of our podcasts on the 2SER website. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you to our guests, Greg Greenhill, Tamara Vininsky, and Sam Moy. My name's Jack Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week. Thank you.